We live in a world where many, if not most people, believe that someone can't just walk down the street and a brick falls off a building, hits them, and kills them. They were just going about their business and a minor unintentional slip at a construction site between parking their car and reaching their destination results in their death. Maybe it's not something that falls. Maybe it's the person who falls, just tripped and hit their head and it's over. Well, it's happened. Not to you, maybe not to even anyone you know, but it has happened. The human mind, so sophisticated, sometimes it's hard to fathom that something so simple could be the reason for something so massive. Did one man with a rifle and access to a building overlooking the motorcade route published in the paper just days before really alter the course of the United States? It's a simple answer for some. No way. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. The Dallas Police Department was not working on a theory at the very beginning that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. I'm not talking about thinking there was a second shooter. I mean, they acted as if perhaps Oswald had help in carrying out the assassination. At least that's what it seems police might have been thinking when they interrogated Buell Wesley Frazier, who drove Oswald to work that morning. Frazier spent quite some time at police headquarters in the assassination aftermath.
I was down there for many hours, and they drilled me and quizzed me for hours and hours. Different teams trying to see if I'd say something different or I'd tell them something different. Well, I only had one story to tell them. And finally, the two detectives, Detective Rhodes and Detective Stovall, they tell Will Fritz, he says, "This kid has told us everything he knows."
But Frazier says when the detectives were ready to move on, Captain Will Fritz was not.
And he tried to get me to sign a confession. Now, to anybody that's kin to Will Fritz, I would tell this. I'm sure as long as he worked for the Dallas Police Department, he did a lot of good things. But the way he treated me that day and tried to get me to sign a confession that I knew of and was part of the assassination of John F. Kennedy was totally, he was totally out of order. The way he treated me. He tried to get me to sign a confession, and when I wouldn't sign that, he got so mad he started to hit me. And I threw my arm up to block to keep him from striking me. And I told him, I says, "You know, this policeman on the outside of this door here. But I said, before they get in here, I said, you and I are going to have a hell of a fight if you hit me." So he snatches the paper up and a pen and walks out, and I've never seen him until this day.
Dallas police were also chasing down claims from people that Lee Harvey Oswald knew Jack Ruby. Immediately after Ruby killed Oswald, District Attorney Henry Wade called that news conference to go over evidence. You heard portions of that earlier. But later in the same news conference, questions turned to Ruby.
Do you know of any connection between Mr. Ruby and the...
I know him now.
Are you investigating reports that he might have been slain because Ruby might have feared he would implicate him in something?
The police are making the investigation of that murder. I don't know anything about that.
Is the investigation...
Although charges have been filed, it will be presented to a grand jury on Ruben.
Then more specifically, reporters wanted to know if Wade had any relationship with him, as Wade tried keeping control of the news conference.
Did you know Ruby before this?
No, sir. Saw him in this very same room Friday night when we had the defendant up here.
He threw a stag party for the Texas Bar Association in the Adolphus Hotel. Were you there?
No, sir, I wasn't there. As a matter of fact, if some of you will recall, he asked a question from out here in the audience, or answered a question. He's standing right back here, and I didn't know who he was. I thought he was a member of the press, and he told me as we walked out of here that he was a nightclub operator here.
What question did he ask?
What?
What question did he ask?
I don't remember, but he...
The answer one, I think.
Maybe it was an answer, but he said something.
Remember it was Friday night when I asked you to do an interview with me on the phone, and you had another call, and Ruby was hanging around in the background. You were on the phone, and I said, and then you had to go away, and I asked Ruby, because he seemed to me like a detective. He seemed to be all over this place. I said, would you see if you could get him on the phone? came to here now, and he went around, and he got you, and he brought you over by telephone.
It might have been where he told me who he was. I didn't know who he was either when he... I think someone here answered that question in that he answered a question. Somebody asked something and he answered it back there, and I don't know what it was. I think it is some question about a street or an address or a name or something.
About a week after the assassination, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover gives his assessment of Jack Ruby, also known as Jacob Rubenstein, to President Lyndon Johnson in this recorded telephone call between the two men.
They accepted him as kind of a police character hanging around police. A bad record, street brawler, fighter, and that sort of thing. And they, in the place in Dallas, if a fellow came in there and couldn't pay his bill completely, Rubenstein would beat the very devil out of him and throw him out of the place. He was that kind of a fella. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, boasted about that. He is what I would put in the category, one of the egomaniacs. He likes to be in the limelight. He knew all the police in that white light district where the joints are in there. And he also let him come in, see the show, get food and get liquor and so forth. That's how I think he got into police headquarters, because they accepted him as kind of a police character hanging around police headquarters. And for that reason, raised no question.
Hoover then railed against the actions of the police department for the way Oswald was transferred.
They never made any moves as the pictures show, even when they saw him approaching this fella, and got up right to him and pressed his pistol against Oswald's stomach. Neither of the police officers on either side made any moves to push him away or to grab him. It wasn't until after the gun was fired that they then moved. Now, of course, that is not the highest degree of efficiency, so to say. Secondly, the chief of police admits that he moved him in the morning as a convenience and at the request of the motion picture people who wanted to have daylight. He should have moved him at night, but he didn't.
Dallas Police Detective Jim Lavelle says they chased leads on Ruby, knowing Oswald, for some time. One time, a tip came from a preacher.
One preacher came forward and he said, well, I used to take a walk in the morning and meet Ruby and talk to him. He said, one morning, Father, when I met him and standing there talking to him, he said, a young man walked up and Ruby said, I want you to meet a friend of mine here, and introduced Lee Harvey Oswald to me. This preacher, we asked him to come down and take a polygraph test to prove that he is what he said was so. Mm-hmm. Then he broke down and admitted he made it all up.
Another time, a tip came from a lawyer.
He said he and his girlfriend went to the Carousel Club, and Oswald come in and sit down at a table next to him, and Ruby come over and sit down and talk to him. And he could hear them discussing shooting the governor and all this kind of thing. And he could count that word for word from all that conversation.
So that being a significant lead, police tried to at least confirm it.
Our intelligence division took the lead in it and run it down. And they found the girlfriend. And she turned out to be a $100 a night hooker. And she told us, well, not only did we not see Ruby, we didn't even go to the Carousel Club.
All right, let's go back to the 1970s. In 1975, the Zapruder film is shown on national television for the first time. Its shocking, unaltered view of the assassination begins to confirm in some people's minds that the shot that killed President Kennedy came from the front because of the reaction of President Kennedy's body in the half-second following being hit. A private screening of the Zapruder film was then shown to Congress, and then legislation put forward to reopen the assassination case. The House Select Committee on Assassination's task was to reinvestigate the murders of two Americans, President John F. Kennedy and Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Several panels were put together, including professionals and experts in their industry. One such panel examined the medical evidence. A part of that panel was Dr. Cyril Wecht, a renowned forensic pathologist and believer that shots were fired at President Kennedy from multiple directions. Wecht has been highly critical of the autopsy performed on President Kennedy's body the night of the assassination at Bethesda Naval Hospital by doctors James Humes and Thornton Boswell.
You have two pathologists, Humes and Boswell, performing this autopsy, who were career naval people who had never performed a single medical legal gunshot wound case in their entire careers. Pierre Fink, an Army man, was called over from the AFIP, Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, in D.C. He arrived late, an Army man, junior in rank, in that naval setting. The brain had already been removed, And every time Pierre asked a question, he was told just to move on. A gruff voice from the background, one of the admirals or generals, we can be sure. So basically, this was an autopsy performed then by two people who had never done such a case. That is to begin with. Then they completely missed a bullet hole in the front of the president's neck. They thought that that was strictly a tracheostomy, a surgical incision which is done properly into a person's windpipe to take care of the basic physiological needs.
Okay. When doctors operated on President Kennedy at Parkland Hospital, one of the life-saving procedures they elected to try was a tracheostomy, to help the body breathe, essentially. There was a bullet wound at the base of the throat. Whether or not this was the right thing to do, doctors decided to go through the existing wound to insert the tube. That then obliterated the original wound.
Now, a good forensic pathologist would have understood that and picked it up. These guys never did. They concluded that night that a bullet found on beneath a stretcher back at Parkland Hospital by Darrell Tomlinson, a maintenance man trying to get to the men's room, that afternoon, after the entourage associated with the president had left, he found this bullet. That information was relayed to the FBI in D.C. and then on to over to Bethesda, where they were doing the autopsy, and they came to the absolutely incredible, absurd conclusion that that stretcher bullet was the bullet that had entered the president's back beyond the length of an adult man's finger, which they used to probe, and had made its way back out through the same small 7x4 millimeter hole. Absolute impossibility, but that's what they said. The next day, when they learned about the hole in the president's neck, they said, ah, the bullet did go through and exited the neck.
Another outspoken critic of the way the autopsy was performed on Kennedy is Dr. Gary Aguilar, who was not associated with the House committee itself.
They didn't dissect the wounds, apparently because they were ordered not to dissect the wounds. Somebody in the autopsy room, as Dr. Humes and Boswell and Dr. Fink said, directed that they not dissect the back wound, which would have determined the trajectories. And they weren't allowed to see Jack Kennedy's clothing. There was numerous evidence of interference during the autopsy. The body arrived at Bethesda. The autopsy pathologists were told, listen, he was shot from above and behind. They've captured the man who shot him from above and behind. He fell forward with the fatal shots, i.e. indicating being shot from behind. Here's the body. Figure it out.
One of the witnesses called by the House Select Committee was Robert Groden, so he could present the Zapruder film to the committee in an official session. He was tasked with examining other films and photographs.
Congressman Downing called me to his office and asked if I would be the photographic consultant to the committee when it got formed. And I jumped at it, said, certainly, absolutely. And they constantly, for a total of about 3 years, were sending me photographic materials for me to analyze and give opinions about and try to improve visually. And I was very, very proud of that, too.
The House committee, though, did more than just examine what you could see. Also, what you can hear. This is probably one of the most, if not the most, controversial portion of what the committee did. It is also used to base the possibility that there might have been a conspiracy. The committee examined evidence coming from a stuck-open microphone from a Dallas police motorcycle officer. It was believed at the time that the stuck-open microphone came from an officer who was well behind the presidential limousine in the motorcade. Sound experts studied the audio for any evidence of gunshots. The team concluded there were shots in the audio. Then another team deployed to Dealey Plaza in downtown Dallas. They shot rifles from key areas in Dealey Plaza into sandbags on Elm Street. Various microphones were placed throughout the streets of Dealey Plaza, and those recordings were studied and compared to that stuck-open police microphone. Years later, more studies were done to the audio from the police dictabelt, and questions started coming up. Where's the crowd noise? Where are the sirens? Then a television program on ABC suggested the stuck-open microphone at the time of the assassination wasn't in the motorcade at all and could have actually been from a motorcycle at the Dallas Trade Mart where President Kennedy was to speak. Will we ever know what this is? Maybe not. But here it is. Here is the piece of audio the committee studied. What do you hear? There are certainly pops that can be heard, but are they gunshots, or is that just static? Does that sound like it could be from an open microphone on a motorcycle that is moving slowly, or is it stationary? Is that from the motorcade, or is it somewhere else? Just adds more questions, doesn't it? Well, the House Select Committee on Assassinations concluded that there was a high probability of two gunmen. They say the Warren Commission was right when it said Lee Harvey Oswald fired three shots from the Texas School Book Depository, but based on the highly controversial acoustic analysis, they determined there was one shot from the front, specifically from the grassy knoll. But they say that shot missed. Missed? Why, yes, says the House Committee. In all the possibilities of conspiracy put forward by researchers on multiple gunmen and the headshot having to come from the front given the backward motion of the president's body, the House Committee said, sure, we'll give you a fourth shot. We'll say it came from the picket fence. But it didn't hit anything. And Oswald was still the only gunman who did. Questions of conspiracy expand on more than just the actual assassination now. There's a second conspiracy argument, of course, one of a cover-up. That one actually has a surprising supporter. FBI agent Jim Hostie, who interrogated Oswald after the assassination at police headquarters. First of all, Hostie does not think the assassination itself was anything more than Lee Harvey Oswald firing three shots.
People get two and two added up and it gets to be six and a half, you know.
But he does think it was what he calls a benign cover-up.
They did it because they didn't want to start World War III. Wouldn't you say that's benign?
They're trying to protect the country instead of protecting themselves.
Well, how did World War I start?
An assassination.
Right. And when the by a weaker country backed up by a powerful country, Tsarist Russia, and they wanted to, the Austrians wanted to carry on a investigation within Serbia's borders, or be present while Serbia was doing it, and they said, "Oh, that would infringe upon our sovereignty." And next thing we know, they're starting a war.
This is also when Hostie says his superiors were keeping information from him involving that Mexico City trip Oswald took in the weeks prior to the assassination. Was that a cover-up? If an assassination started World War I, Hostie argues, just take a similar scenario in the build-up to the Kennedy assassination.
They would have wanted to go to Cuba and talk to the Cubans. There were mysterious planes leaving the United States suddenly with Cuban agents and so forth. You can't prove that they're in any way connected, but it was suspicious looking. I'd say that was, we didn't want to get that out. See, that the government told the truth, they just didn't tell the whole truth.
Hostie himself admits to being part of a cover-up. Again, a benign one, he argues. But what he did was he obeyed orders from his superior. Before the assassination, Hostie went to speak to Marina Oswald when Lee Oswald was not present. Lee and Marina were not living together in the weeks leading up to the assassination. When Lee Oswald found out Hostie went to speak to Marina, he paid Hostie a visit, but Hostie was unavailable.
Oswald got all shook up and came in and wrote this note out to me about, you leave my wife alone, don't talk to her. You come talk to me if you want to, but don't bother my wife. Well, maybe he was afraid she knew too much, and that's why he didn't want us to talk to her.
Now, 2 days after the assassination, when Oswald was killed, Hostie was called to the office of his supervisor, Gordon Shanklin.
About 10 o'clock at night, Shanklin called me into his office and gave me the note and says, here, I don't want to ever see this again. Now, Shanklin, contrary to what some people reported, has never denied that he gave me the order. He says he doesn't remember it. Ken Howe, the supervisor, does testify that Shanklin did send for me, and he stood in the doorway, and Shanklin was saying something to me, and he handed me the note. He won't go so far as to say that he told me to get rid of it. Actually, he didn't get rid of it. He said, I don't ever want to see this again. Later, he did ask me, he said, did you get rid of it? And I said, yes. And he said, okay, good. Now, there's witnesses to that, too.
It will never be proven what the note said. It was never admitted into any evidence because Hostie, at Shanklin's orders, tore the note up and flushed it down the toilet. There were some elements involving Lee Harvey Oswald's 3 years in Russia that possibly scared the crap out of the powers that be in Washington, but this is before really anyone knew what was going on. Some really interesting testimony that came out of the House Committee's investigation came from the former head of the CIA, Richard Helms. Now, Helms was not yet head of the CIA at the time of Kennedy's assassination, but at that time, he was director of plans within the agency. That's also known as the Director of National Clandestine Service. Helms spoke about a defector from the Soviet Union in the weeks after the assassination who wanted the U.S. to know that Lee Harvey Oswald was not affiliated with the KGB. But being a little paranoid, as a CIA can be sometimes, could the federal government trust this guy? This is from Helms' testimony to the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
On January 23, 1964, in Geneva, that's in Geneva, Switzerland, Mr. Yuri Nosenko requested that he be permitted to defect to the West. Mr. Nosenko's request was accompanied by a claim that he could give a comprehensive report on Lee Harvey Oswald's contacts and connections with the KGB during Oswald's stay in the Soviet Union between 1959 and 1962. It is difficult to overstate the significance that Yuri Nosenko's defection assumed in the investigation of President Kennedy's assassination. If Mr. Nosenko turned out to be a bona fide defector, if his information were to be believed, then we could conclude that the KGB and the Soviet Union had nothing to do with Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963, and therefore had nothing to do with President Kennedy's murder. If, on the other hand, Mr. Nosenko had been programmed in advance by the KGB to minimize KGB connections with Oswald, if Mr. Nosenko was giving us false information about Oswald's contacts with the KGB in 1959 to 1962, it was fair for us to surmise that there may have been an Oswald-KGB connection in November 1963, more specifically, that Oswald was acting as a Soviet agent when he shot President Kennedy. If it were shown that Oswald was in fact acting as a Soviet agent when he shot President Kennedy, the consequences to the United States of America, and indeed to the world, would have been staggering.
In the end, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, while believing a probable conspiracy involving a second gunman and fourth shot, again, a shot that missed, did rule out some things. If a conspiracy existed to kill President Kennedy, it did not involve the Soviet Union. If a conspiracy existed to kill President Kennedy, it did not involve Cuba. If a conspiracy existed to kill President Kennedy, it did not involve the mob. And if a conspiracy existed to kill President Kennedy, it did not involve elements of the CIA, the FBI, or the Secret Service. The assassination was just a year and a month after the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, and investigators, at least some of them, seemed uneasy that their accused assassin spent years in the Soviet Union. Imagine, though, what it was like for those people just going about their business on that day when the assassination happened. I'm talking about the reporters who covered a presidential tour of Texas they thought was going to wrap up, but instead they were forced to maintain their composure while reporting on the breaking news. Secret Service officers who had to keep on going without taking a break to mourn the death of the man they were supposed to protect. It was challenging enough for Americans to move on, but the impact this had on those who were there that day, that stays for a lifetime. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas.